a new interpretation of valency based on some of the new ideas on the
San Francisco. They got the guys on the ferry and the rest of them. And they told him, well, sure, we've had this fellow Beckman working with us all summer to improve our process on here. You see, like that we've been doing. So I found out that they had been selling additional stock on the ground that they'd had a professor from Caltech polish up the details of the process and like that. Oh. They're out selling more and more.
They were
clever out there. They thought, well, we had a trial up there then, and I was expert for the state. I went back then to Oakland and appeared before Earl Warren and his staff. They were all standing around ready to arrest me, you know. I showed them my notebooks. Fortunately, I'd kept copious notes and stuff. I told them this story, and they showed them the whole thing. Their jaws dropped because Wetherill had taken them in. He was such a persuasive guy. He was convinced I was in collusion with him. You see, when they found the facts, why it swung around the other way, and I became state witness then for the state. Well, they finally sent him up for 5 years each for selling stock without a license and that. There's more to it than that, though. They had a professor from Berkeley over there to testify to how big a sample it took. I'm going into much detail on this, but it is part of chemistry, because it finally came down that Cox is going to put on a demonstration in the courtroom. Well, was it safe? So they had some professors from Caltech to testify whether it was safe from a fire standpoint or not. Mm-hmm. And these people got themselves confused. Yeah, also at the beginning of the trial, I saw how lucky I was. See, I was there as an expert. So they're going to show that I was not an expert. So they came up to Beckman, now you're an expert. Well, I said, well, I think I know enough about all chemistry to handle the facts that come up here. Well, that could, I suppose you tell the judge about Schellmuger oil. Well, now, do you know Schellmuger oil?
Roger Adams worked on it.
That's right. But sheer luck, Roger Adams had worked on that. So I said, yes, that's suspected as being something can help on leprosy and all that. And Professor Adams, University of Illinois, they closed their book and put it down. And they had a battery of five or six lawyers, and another one said, well, now, suppose you tell us about the law of mass action, and can you explain this? And they gave a very simple thing. Said, well, I was teaching this to my students at that time. And she said, well, that's a very good simplified version of what you really ought to do is put an activity coefficient in here, and something like that, you know. They closed the book and sat down. Of all the things they could have shown me up at anything, but the two things I was familiar with were done. Well, that's part of the same background. So then Cox is going to show that this catalyst clay he had was mixed with something that would dehydrate oil. My God, he's going to show that on the court as well. And he said that this wrapper he was using, you know, solid, was just an inert castor oil. Well, I'd done some work for Treatolite at this time on sulfonated oil for use for dehydrating this thing. And this looked like Treatolite to me. And so I asked for a sample. Well, how big a sample? That's where they got the professor from Berkeley involved. He couldn't tell them how many cubic centimeters there were in a pint. And I said, well, a few cc's would be enough for what I think it is. But they just got him so rattled that finally I got about 100 cubic centimeters in a sample. In fact, I told him what I think it is, one drop would do the thing. So I took that and the next day in the trial, I took this sample and shook it up and found it was soluble in water. Then I took castor oil, found it completely insoluble in water. I said, this is not castor oil, this is a sulfonated castor oil. And they were pinned down, found out for perjury. They claimed they got it from a Union Oil station that had been closed down for a year before, something like that. So they got it on perjury all the way through. But make a long story short, that was the Cox oil refining case. It sounded like a Hollywood scenario, but it, oh, I went up to this plant out there where they had the refinery, had a moat around it, and a drawbridge and an armed guard with six shooters and like that. So
because
I was privileged to go in there, but that hole was a. And the weather going around in his 16 cylinder Cadillac. And now that's
great.
That's some chemistry, applied chemistry, you see, a little different nature, but still part of my experience.
So, and you worked with Earl Warren on your testimony in that trial.
Yeah, but he thought he was going to put me in jail. You see that as well?
That's very interesting. So that's one of, was that your first experience with expert witnessing?
Probably as expert witnessing. I had a rather unusual rare case in the same sort of thing, Treatolite Company. which had patents on sulfonate of castor oil, was being sued. And the litigants, they had a lawyer there, Judge Holzer, who couldn't understand what would be in sense. So he got both sides to agree to have an expert come up and help him. So they called me out of class, right in the middle of the class at Caltech. Both defendant and plaintiff agreed that they'd have me there. So I went up, sat on the bench beside the judge. And if somebody didn't understand, well, he'd ask me, and I'd ask him a question. I'd suggest a question to him to ask the plaintiff. And this went on for the whole trial. As far as I know, that's the only time where an expert actually sat up alongside a federal judge and did this. And when it was over, both sides claim, I forget which side won. I think the Frito-Lay plaintiff won, I think. But both sides said they felt they'd never had a fair trial, because the first time they thought they had a judge who really knew what the score was in a technical setting. So that was a rather another unusual experience.
Was that before the Cox Oil controversy?
I don't know. It was about the same time. Mm-hmm. Whether just before or just after, I don't know.
Well, it sounds like you were spending more and more of your time in these sorts of activities. Do you recall about how much time you, in the early 30s, before Glenn Joseph, or before National Postal Meter and then Glenn Joseph, how much time were you spending on the outside?
I'd just be guessing. No, I don't know. But it took a considerable amount of time, particularly when I got into this Cox process, oil process thing, because that took a lot of commuting. During the summer there, when I'd go up, I'd fly up. This is when the Varney Airlines had the Lockheed Vegas, the little four-passenger plane. They'd make it an hour and 58 minutes back there. Quite often, I'd be the only passenger up there. You had a cockpit lifted up, and the passengers had to climb in, and the pilot sat right down in the lap of the front two passengers. You know, but it was a fast little plane.
Well, it's the early days of commercial aircraft.
That must have been, well, about 32, because I building my house at this time, at 33, so just before that, because one of the charges, the lawyers were pretty rough. They accused me of perjuring my testimony because I needed money to finish my house. It was under construction. They accused me of having affairs with the secretary of, so they accused me of everything on there, but fortunately the lawyers prepared me to advance for question they're going to have, because they did this of all the witnesses, you know. So
that was you said that you'd gotten into the Cox Oil thing through Lyon and Lyon, I believe. And so that you had contact with them before filing these patents for the inking device and the pH meter, which is the next one that we should move on to. I was just the reason I raised that to begin with, and I'm glad it led into that very interesting story, is just that it's not. You don't learn in graduate school in chemistry how to file for a patent, and I was just wondered if you'd say a little bit more about your first few experiences with gaining patents.
Oh, you talk to a patent attorney, and he usually drafts the thing. You give him a technical description of what you think the invention is, then he puts it in proper terminology and form for filing a patent application.
When did it occur to you that it would make sense to file for a patent for the pH meter? If we can move on to that. Here's the patent, which was filed in the fall of 1934, which must have been shortly after Glenn Joseph approached you.
Yeah. Well, I guess about the time we decided to produce these things on here. See, this is not a pH meter. See, that's just the amplifier.
Right.
And so it's later on that we put the things all together in a little walnut case. Oh, I think just, if I was going to be in business, just the concept of having a patent is a necessary thing to protect your rights.
That had come out of these earlier experiences, partly, and just...
I think anybody would have that idea. If you made an invention, or anybody else made an invention, gee, I'll get a patent on it. That was...
There were people on the Illinois faculty who had done this sort of thing, like Parr and his calorimeter would be an example. Were there people
they probably had, but I had no relation with them whereby I could gain from their experience on it. I don't recall ever discussing patents with anybody at Illinois until I showed the pH meter to G. Frederick Smith and others at San Francisco in September 1935.
Mm-hmm. But had were anyone people on the Caltech faculty doing similar things to your knowledge at this time? Or
no, I had a brother who was a lawyer. And so he was the one who filed a patent application on, I guess we arrived, my first patent was for a speedometer warning device. And my brother took care of that. So I may have soaked up from him think about the necessity of patenting. But he didn't have anything to do with this, though.
When was that?
But that was 28, I think, possibly 29.
This is a speedometer in a car?
Yeah.
You missed that. Dr. Beckman said that it may have had something to do with the fact that he was getting too many tickets for driving.
I have a reputation, probably unjustified, of being a fast driver out there.
I'm glad to know there's someone else.
Well, you see, I had to do that in self-protection. I wanted to cut down my chance of being involved in an accident. If you go faster than the rest, you'll never get hit from the rear. So you cut down your, probably by a factor of two.
Good reasoning. Unfortunately, the highway patrol must not have agreed. Sure. But if we can get back to, I've alluded to your encounter with Glenn Joseph in the fall of 1934 a couple of times, and I showed you this book by Lamott et al. On pH and its industrial applications, and in there they talk about the state of the art in the early 30s for measuring pH, and it was there were two methods mainly, the colorimetric method using indicator solutions and the electrometric method using hydrogen electrodes. And I wonder if you could just say a few things about what you began to discover as you worked on the problem for Glenn Joseph.
Well, I'm surprised this book apparently did not mention the Gauss electrode. The Gauss electrode was known and was in fact was being made commercially by Legion Northrop at that time. And in fact, goes clear back to Fritz Haber, you know. 1909, something like that. I think he was the one who demonstrated this phenomenon. And later on, there's a British woman biochemist in the 25-26 period did some excellent work with a glass electrode using a proper instrument, which is an electrometer. So she was. So the technique was known.
That was published in the literature.
Published in the literature, yes, at that time. So I told Glenn Joseph, said, a galvanometer is the wrong instrument. You need an electrometer. The galvanometer is a current measuring instrument. Even the Legion Northrop high sensitivity HS galvanometer, which is the best at that time, that needed, had a sensitivity, as I recall, about 10th to minus 9th amp. Well, that's a lot of current. And if you work it back, if you want to have a sensitivity of, say, 59 millivolts per pH, so say, 10th of a millivolt, I think it worked out, you have to have a maximum electrode resistance of 3 million ohms. That meant it had to be a pretty thin wall, large diameter thing. So I said, your galvanometer just requires too much current. Use a vacuum tube voltmeter. And here again, in my naivety, I assumed that the grid current of a vacuum tube was zero. Therefore, you really had a true electrometer type of thing going there. It was almost zero, but not quite. Later on, when we got into this thing, we found that it was 10th to minus 13th, 14th, minus 15th amps, something like that. And that led again to our use of our recording pH meter as a micro-ammeter. I think I told you about that for monitoring the safety ionization chambers in the atomic energy plants. But I thought that time that the grid current was zero, so I realized this would make it possible to use a much higher electrode resistance and much more rugged electrode.
Where did you get these parts? Did you just pull them off the shelf, or did you have to make them yourself? Did you make the glass electrode yourself?
Oh, sure. They're nothing to it. Yeah. See, in fact, another proof that this is Corning made a special glass, Corning 015 glass, which was the particular combination of the lowest point in the eutectic system on there, and had the highest electrical conductivity of any of the glasses. That was being used for making the glass electrodes. And so there's no chore to melt down the end and blow a bulb on the end of this thing. Sure. I put an arm on the side, to fit on in this thing. There are a lot of little things in here that are not patentable. For example, one of the problems is if you scrape the electrode against the side of the beaker, the electrode will break. So we put on a square electrode rod, a ring stand rod instead of that, and put in so it could rotate. We put stops on there so it had to go. And that was rather in it because we put stops so that we wouldn't push electrode to the bottom of the beaker, but also that meant that we were immersing the electrode to a constant depth. But about the time we came out with our pH meter, there was a very disturbing publication, I think by professors at Stanford University, saying that a glass electrode really measures the depth of immersion rather than pH. And they'd made an electrode out of a length of 0.15 tubing, and they found that it got different pH readings depending on how deeply that was immersed in the liquid. Well, that was devastating to us, and we finally looked into it and found out, sure enough, it was true. So what he didn't realize, that there's a leakage path over the outside of the electrode and down inside, and the higher your electrode came up, the shorter this leakage path. So that would give me. So that's when we started to overcome that. The surface resistivity of Corning 0.15 glass is pretty low. So we started coating it with shellac and with resins of various kinds, PC and wax, you know, we'd melt on everything like that. Finally, we decided that these were just temporary, unsuitable things, that the only way was to get rid of that that interface. That led to our patent on the sealed electrode. That was the thing that really gave us a stranglehold on the glass electrode business.
I see. How soon after the introduction of this instrument was that?
Not too long after that. I'll have to look up and see what we got a basic patent protection on that. I've forgotten the date of that now, but yeah, gosh, I recall how the consternation we had when we read about this work at Stanford, right?
I can see why that would have given you pause.
That's right. Of course, then we got into other results too. We found, of course, was knowing that if you started measuring high pH, why the electrode began to function as a sodium electrode as well as a hydrogen electrode. So then we started our glass electrode research. We studied thousands and thousands of glass compositions to come up with glasses that are specially suited for this or that, either high pH reading or for even sodium measurement or potassium measurement, something like that.
Well, this did you? One thing that I wondered in reading over the story of your encounter with Glenn Joseph and the early acid imager work, did you ever go up to the Fruit Growers Exchange?
Go where?
Did you ever go to visit his operation?
Oh yes.
Growers Exchange?
Yes.
Now, what we have? Let's see, where is it? We have an article on the that appeared on the Fruit Growers Exchange. This is from the Journal of Chemical Education. And I just wondered what you. Now, if it was common for you to go and visit the laboratories or the places where you were doing things.
Yes, well, Joseph's boss out there was a PhD from, I'm not sure he's a PhD. He was a Caltech student named Bill Baier, B-A-E-R. Mm-hmm. And he was always research-oriented, I think as a result of his exposure to Caltech. And so the California Fruit Growers Exchange, that's the Sunkist Group, were always investigating things, new fertilizers and pesticides and ways of eliminating scale on oranges and the development of byproducts. So if there was a research atmosphere, see, a citrus byproduct, that, that I associated with it. It was not very prepossessing quarters out there. This is in Ontario where they were. Pectin plant on there, yeah. Yeah, formic calcium citrate, citric acid production, lemon oil.
And did you check the sort of methods he was using at the time?
He was using
high sensitivity galvanometer.
Yeah, and that, you see, had to have an optical lever on it, you know, that had a mirror on it, you know, and you had to shine a beam of light out that, and then a meter out, you had this big scale. So that's what he was using, and he was had his galvanometer suspended in a hopefully vibration isolating suspension, so springs on it, but that wasn't enough. There's enough plant vibrations, the thing would break it quite often.
And let's see if we can move on then from just briefly from the introduction of the acidimeter and
let me insert that we may have people interrupting us. 4:30, we can certainly run on until people do appear, but we should sort of draw towards closure. I'm sure Dr. Beckman is need of a...
I'm under no time constraints.
No, there are just two other things that I did want to cover. One, I hope we can get to the DU, because that's one thing that in all the interviews that we've been reading, hardly anybody's talked to you about the early years or the development of the DU, and I hope we can get to that.
You didn't see this film that Smith Kline made for our 50th anniversary.
No.
That was shown last night and also shown out at Dark Lake. That's an interesting film. You ought to try to see that. Mm-hmm. And Bruce Merrifield makes a statement. I'm surprised. He says that the DU probably was the most important instrument developed in the advancement of bioscience, something like that. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised that he'd be so generous, but we do have him on record for that.
Yeah, well, we shall certainly have to get a hold of that and take a look at it. And so I would like to get onto that. But at this point, one thing I wanted to ask about was you told the story of the shift from the National Inking Appliance Company to the name National Technical Laboratories, and you began to explore marketing the acidimeter, and went to see the various scientific instrument companies in the fall, I believe it was the fall of 1935.
That's right.
After the ACS meeting in San Francisco, and that Arthur H. Thomas was the first company to take an interest in it. But shortly after that, we find this Eimer and Ammann catalog.
Yes.
With an illustration of your apparatus.
That's right. Well, we had, in a short time, we had all of the apparatus, 28. All of them were selling our interest on that. So Arthur Thomas, Eimer and Ammann, Central Scientific, PH Sargent, and the whole, mm-hmm. whole bunch upon there. So that, and we had a one-man sales force, this Tom Harrington. All he did was go around and pick up orders from the different dealer. Then in 1960, whether something like that, we shifted from our dealer method operator. This was a major business decision made, because here we had all of the apparatus dealers in the country selling our product. If we cut them off, we knew we'd have all of them as our competition. Mm-hmm. And yet we felt we had to do it, because we were not getting information back from our users. That's the first thing. The apparatus dealers, many of them, not Arthur H. Thomas, they were always a fine group. I'm sorry we had a break with them. Our large, we could not make an exception. But several of our dealers, particularly Fisher and Eimer, were coming up with their own competitive thing, taking the know-how that they developed handling ours. But more importantly, they were not passing on to us word from our users. We didn't know what the experience the users was, what they wanted in the way of new instrumentation, things like that. So we decided for the long range, we had to have direct connection with our users. So in whatever it was, 60 or something like that, we broke with all of our dealers. This created quite a little surprise in Wall Street. They thought we were out of our minds, and we thought perhaps it might have been too. But anyway, it's worked out fine since, because now we work closely with our users for their benefit and for ours too. But that was a major and a very tough business decision to make.
And so at this time, it must, since Eimer and Ammann, well, this is right after you talked to Arthur Thomas Company, which was the first to pick up the pH meter, they must have seen a larger market for it than they saw initially, since they began to carry it right away.
Well, I think it's like a bunch of sheep. If one dealer sells something, pretty soon the rest of them follow in line, yeah.
And this is just one of the early
acidimeters. Yeah, this is called acidimeter. Well, we had to change that name because there were, I mentioned, two types of acidimeter. One was determined total acid, which is just a titration technique, and the other is the hydrogen ion concentration. So we changed that over to pH.
Yeah, this must have been before 1940, because it still has the 3300 East address there.
Oh, yes. Yeah, this goes back to probably 1936. This is our first, this is our first promotional brochure. I think our first publication, which I must get you, is a little thing about so, that whatever executive should know about pH. That explains the pH scale in non-technical terms.
Well, the growth of the pH meter business and the growth of NTL's business is well covered in Golden Past, Golden Future. By what you might say a few more words about, or how you began to expand into other areas based on the kinds of electronics and optical systems that you were using in the early equipment.
I mentioned to you how we got into the helipod business. That was by chance, the radiation lab found we had this thing. That was our result of our determination to have a better component. We didn't even have sense enough to measure its linearity or to put it on the market as an item of sale. It was just a component replacement part for a pH meter to show how narrow-minded we were in our thinking. But then the development of the spectra, that was a deliberate attempt. I realized that in this amplifier, we had a very good stable DC amplifier that would work with vacuum-type photocells that give a linear response. That was a deliberate attempt to go out. And I mentioned earlier, we went back to Rochester, talked to one of the big optical companies, and they were not interested. Thing. So we had to go back and do our own optical design on the thing. Not only optical design, but mechanical design. There are a lot of features in here that users don't realize. For example, the friction on the bearing that holds the prism mount would cause just a little bit of deflection of the arm, just enough to bring in a slight inaccuracy on there. Well, things like that we had to worry about. And just a straightforward mechanical design of. You don't think when you look at it now, it's just obvious you had to have a bearing under there, but it doesn't say it took months and months of testing to find it.
How large was the company at that time, and how much specialized help could you call on?
Well, this is in 40, I guess it was, 39 or thereabouts, when we started to work on this. We probably had a couple hundred employees. I have to go back. Remind me, I'll go back and look in our annual reports. It'll tell us that.
Did that mean most of those people were in production or in sales? I mean, how much?
Well, we always had about, roughly 10% of our people were in development, research and development, and the rest of them were production.
Now here we have an article in the Journal of the Optical Society of America in 1941 on the.
This one to carry myself. Yeah, that was the first publication. That was in when?
41.
41. Yeah, that'd be about right.
And it was you wrote that in the spring of that year.
Yeah.
I wonder if you would just talk a little bit about the degree to which chemists were using spectrophotometers, visible spectra, as analytical tools at the time. And
They were used to some extent, but not widely used. Mm-hmm. Of course, at that time you had a matching field technique, you know, and that, and that's very tiring, and it's not very precise, and. That's why this optical company was making these things. There's just no great market for them. They're not very popular instruments. And I realized that if we could, first of all, relieve the human fatigue, first of all, and second of all, get it to be an objective rather than a subjective determination, and also extend the optical range beyond the visual. These are the three things. Those are obvious to me at the time.
So you were doing... In this case, you were doing something very similar to what you did with the pH meter, which was to design the steel into the machine.
It's always been our thing. We build a complication into the machine to simplify. As I mentioned, the newest example is our Fourier transform infrared spectra. Did you ever see that?
Mm-hmm. No.
Well, you must come out and see that.
Yep.
That's a marvelous sensor. Not a single control knob on it.
Mm-hmm.
We standardized that. That's a single beam type of IO average sensor type of thing. We got things so stable now we can calibrate that at the factory and run for weeks or months after that. It's got built into it lasers, it's got an interferometer built into the thing, and very, very complicated things inside, but for the user it's a simple thing to use.
When you were with the by 39-40, were you drawing on other people at Caltech or elsewhere as consultants in the sort of development side of things?
Yeah. Yes, not so much at Caltech, because Caltech, I say, was not an applied science group one there. The only thing we got from Caltech was the Pauling oxygen analyzer, and that we were brought in because they found they couldn't make, I guess I told you that there, they found that making these things to predetermined specifications was quite different from just making a demonstration model or something. But that's about the only thing I recall we ever got from Caltech. We're indebted more to Rockefeller. As I mentioned there, you see, we got the ultracentrifuge from Dr. Pickels, who had been a Rockefeller developer. We got the Moorstein automated amino acid analyzer. And we got the peptide protein synthesizer from Bruce Merrifield. Mm-hmm. Three from Rockefeller.
Where does that Rockefeller connection trace back to?
Dr. Pickels. Mm-hmm. He used to be at the University of Virginia working with beams, you know, who had the air-driven quartz rotor out of center.
Yes, yes.
And then the Rockefeller Institute, this before it was the university, and